This is XTP Media.
Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
You're listening to Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 43 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining me today in the studio is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson. Tim, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Great to be back on the show.
And also we have our Executive Editor of Global Aviation Resource back. Gareth, how are you?
I'm good. It's nice to be back. It feels like it's been a long time.
Yeah, we've missed you. We've missed you.
No, you haven't.
We missed your outtakes.
Thanks.
But before we get going, you've heard our new show supporters, Eventfire Solutions, introducing the program. We're absolutely delighted to have Tony and the team on board. So a very big thank you to everyone at EFS. So in today's program, we get to hear from Tony at EFS about airport support and the role of EFS at airfields, air shows. And being an airport infrastructure focused episode, we've got a fascinating look at how runways, taxiways and other major engineering projects are delivered with Martin O'Connell from AMI. Also, we've got some amusing inserts from the Adam Carolla show about airports and airlines, which we think fit the episode. So we hope you enjoy them and we hope you're not offended by them. But it's been a really busy time. Tim, you've been in Paris. Gareth, you've started a whole new change of direction in life. Tim, let's start with you. Paris.
Yeah, I mean, obviously incredibly busy. It was the, one of the world's busiest air shows, trade exhibitions. Before the show happened, there was a lot of people sort of saying, well, you know, it's going to be like a quiet one this year. Airbus and Boeing have not really got any new products to announce. It should be quite quiet. Didn't really turn out that way. It was still pretty busy. Some of the highlights was that the Bombardier got two of its C-Series over to Paris.
Yep, they looked good.
They looked good, and they sounded even better.
Oh.
Boy, was that aircraft quiet. And more importantly is that they came to Paris. You know, obviously the C-Series has had a lot of troubles. They've been kind of trying to play catch-up. They've now got a new management team, and they came to Paris with better-than-brochure performance figures for the jets.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, very
so
impressive.
So it's more fuel efficient. It's a bit extra range than what they was in the sort of performance specs, which is very, very rare indeed. So they were pretty kind of upbeat about this. Now, they didn't come away with any orders, but what that does is it kickstarts the and kind of reboots their sort of sales effort there to kind of catch up. So that was good news for them. And on the other news, there was news about kind of cargo and kind of cargo market kind of being lifted. Boeing secured some orders for its 747-8, and Airbus announced that it was going to restart its passenger to freight A320 kind of program. So some good news there. You know, quite busy.
Yeah, it was busy. We enjoyed your coverage of the event and the blog in particular. So thanks very much for that. Gareth, what have you been up to since we last spoke to you?
working. I've got a proper job for the first time in quite a long time, which has resulted in a bit of readjustment. So I'm no longer sort of living the dream at my computer in my office at home. I'm off away to work. I'm also doing quite long shifts. I'm also on call and stuff like that. So big change for me, but most enjoyable, I have to say. But
there's a big risk you could get called out tonight. So if Gareth leaves the program at some time, do apologies in advance.
Yeah, I'm on call until we're recording on a Sunday evening. I'm on call until 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. So we'll see. I'm just sitting here praying my phone doesn't ring.
One of the good changes that has crept into your diary is you're going to hopefully be meeting up with me at Yeovilton next week.
Yes, I'm doing 2 days at Air Day this year, helping the team out on a sort of official capacity, which I'm very much looking forward to. So I'm going to be there Friday and obviously show day on Saturday, and looking at the lineup, I can't wait to be there, because unfortunately I have had to drop out of React this year because I'm on call. So Yeovilton's a biggie for me, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing the Etendards and the Rafales and all the other bits and pieces that are going on. They've got some great stuff lined up.
Yeah, well, we're going to bring you a special episode from the show, so we're looking forward to doing that. Okay, let's get started then with this episode and what's caught our eye in the news. Now, being an Apple infrastructure focused episode, of course, the big news in the UK is the recommendation that Heathrow is the airport chosen to expand. Tim, it's not all over yet, is it? Because this is just the Davis Commission coming back with its recommendations. The government has yet to make a formal decision on what it does.
No, I mean, this is not the end. This is not the beginning. This is, I think this is the end of the beginning, in Churchill's words. So Davis Commission has come out, and many people thought it'd be another fudge. It wasn't. He actually came out and said, Heathrow, a third runway at Heathrow is the most optimum solution for Britain going ahead. Gatwick is still, I think, viable or doable, they still said. So, no, deliverable, I think, was the word used. So there's still an in there for Gatwick or the other Heathrow hub type solution. But now, basically, now that the ball is in the government's court, and this is where it gets tricky, because then you get politics, you get Zach Goldsmith, who is going to be running for a sort of conservative, conservative MP. He's opposed to a third runway at Heathrow. He's supposed to be running for London mayor. London mayor Boris Johnson is against it as well, and so there's a major division in the sort of conservative government at the moment about building this thing. And there was some sort of thing I saw when the decision was reached about that we'd had, I don't know, six different war and the government had ignored every single one of them. Since 1945, there's something like about six different sort of commissions or studies or inquiries, and each time events had happened and the politicians had just kind of put it off. So it's not all and cut and dried yet. Watch this space.
Yeah, well, we will. But good news for Heathrow all the same. Puts them in the driving seat. I did, whilst looking up that and doing a bit of research on that item, I did find a really interesting link, which I'll put in the show notes, which is Behind the Scenes, Secrets of Airports, How Airports Are Designed and Particular Ways That They're Approached. So I'll put some link in the show notes. Let's move on, though. Gareth, the F-35, again, we're probably not going to see it this year at RIAT, but it's coming under a bit of a challenge for its performance up against an F-16.
Yeah, this has come from War is Boring, medium.com, and is a report they got their hands on, which apparently was unclassified but labelled for official use only. It's a report from basic fighter maneuver sortie from January of this year, I believe, and it was an F-35, albeit one of the slightly older ones. I think it was AF-02 and F-35A, and that aircraft was up against a two-seat F-16D, which also had two underwing fuel tanks on it. The F-35 was clean, and just as I scan through the piece in question, I'm picking out phrases like, this is obviously referring to the F-35, distinct energy disadvantage for every engagement, insufficient pitch rate, flying qualities were not intuitive or favourable. It's pretty damning.
That's pretty damning stuff, isn't it?
It's one report from one trip. It even says that the pilot's helmet was too large inside the canopy for the pilot to adequately see behind the aircraft, which is that's fairly fundamental. The internet obviously has gone mad for this. People don't need too much encouragement to knock the aircraft, do they? And it is interesting to note that a few people who know, notably one person from the Royal Air Force, has actually come out with his own views. Let's just get that down. Not an official response, but Greek Captain Paul Godfrey, who's involved with the program, has come out with a fairly impassioned defense of the aircraft, has poured a bit of water on the fire, if you like, from this. But yeah, it's just the next chapter, isn't it?
I think it's important to note, though, that the test was not, a closer reading of it. The test, it wasn't set up to be, per se, a dogfight of, somebody to who's going to win. But it was set up in a way for dynamic testing, to see whether the control laws, the software that controls the flight, flight control, the fly-by-wire system, if you like, was too restrictive and because there's an anti-spin logic in there, and I think if you kind of read it carefully, one of the things is that the pilot was saying, the test pilot was saying, is these control laws you have in there are too restrictive in terms of a dogfight. It's making the aircraft too safe, and it needs these software control laws need to be loosened up a bit to give the pilot a bit more control. It's stable enough in high angles of attack, but you can actually kind of give the pilot a bit more control and loosen it up a bit to give them more control in a dynamic against a dynamic maneuvering target, rather than having them so restrictive that it's not going to spin. But on the other hand, you can't actually get your nose pointed or you get on the tail of an F-16.
Absolutely, and I'm sure, the only other two points I would make on this, I'm sure there is a lot of detail in this report that we haven't seen, probably quite a lot of technical detail that isn't in there, and also this is what testing is all about, and these days the software and the additions and upgrades they can make to the software make a huge, huge difference. And I'll tell you what, you can go and ask any Royal Air Force Typhoon pilot about the differences of flying Typhoon now compared to flying it even 5 or 6 years ago. And, that's how powerful these computers are. So, pinch of salt required, but as I said, it's just kind of the next chapter, isn't it? It's the next rocks being thrown at it.
Okay, well, talking technology, let's move further afield then, and into space. Tim, a couple of programs ago, we were talking about the failure of the Russian ISS supply vehicle. Sadly, SpaceX had a failure last week as well with their Dragon supply ship. Again, really, all this is proving is how challenging the space sector is.
Definitely. It's thrown us a bit of a wrench into the SpaceX's sort of plans for sort of manned, to take over the kind of manned crew, NASA's crew transportation contract as well. I mean, it's been a whole run of bad luck, really, for ISS supply runs. They had the Cygnus, Orbital Sciences Cygnus, blew up. Russia's Progress went out of control. SpaceX was the latest one, although today or yesterday, the the Russians have managed to dock a progress.
Yeah,
but at one point, after just immediate afterwards of the SpaceX failure, you know, people were kind of trying to sort of, you know, counting the toilet rolls left on the ISS and how long would you need, and also getting astronauts up to the space station as well, because one of the things is in its current configuration it supports six crew, which people were very, you know, got take a long while to get to this sort of to that sort of state.
Yeah.
So to have the space station run down into kind of minimal life support and only three crew back again because they you know, you can't get the cargo there, I think that would have been a big blow. But luckily, touch wood, you know, progress seems docked okay, and it's going to be sort of for sort of SpaceX and obviously Orbital Sciences as well to get back on track and you know, kind of wear these things out. You know, these things now happen in the public glare. We also tend to forget about you know, the early days of NASA rockets. You know, everyone's seen all the test footage where, you know, the thing blows up on the pad, things goes up turns twizzles in the sky, blows up, you know, and they took a lot of testing.
A lot of practice and testing. Yeah,
the most brilliant montage in the right stuff. Quite humorously done, yep. of all the failures, including the one that sat there and there was sort of puff of smoke and the escape capsule just popped off the top.
Definitely, like a plane cork.
Yeah, although I got to say the SpaceX test of their escape capsule was pretty impressive. We hope to have, for those who have been asking us when the next space episode will come into the air, we'll have a look at that in the next couple of months. We've got so much content at the moment, we struggle to bring time to you, but we will bring some space-focused content to you very, very soon. Then to our final story, some fantastic news. We've seen the Solar Impulse, of course, land in Hawaii. Fantastic news, isn't it, to see that aircraft crossing the Pacific Ocean.
Spirit of adventure, eh? I think it was just looking at the numbers, 118 hours, 8,000 kilometres. And I read a fantastic quote from Andre Borschberg, the pilot, on Facebook last week, saying that blue is no longer his favourite colour.
yeah, he had to stay awake a lot.
Yeah, a new record for a man's solar powered flight. Absolutely incredible. Fair play to them.
Just solar flight in a USA. Incredible stuff. You know, sort of triumph of endurance and just getting, you know, and Gordon Bennett talk about kind of the tension when they, you know, sort of said, oh, there's a storm front ahead, and and then at one point there was some tweet from the Solar Impulse team that said something like, you know, situation difficult or something, and you're thinking, okay, you know, this is getting, you know, sort of quite interesting. But yeah, what an achievement.
Yeah, fantastic. And then just to wrap up updates and news, a fantastic achievement. We had Michael Pickin on the show a few episodes ago. Of course, Michael was at the time the youngest national aerobatic champion for the advanced class, and he was stepping up to the unlimited class. And in his first attempt, at the age of 24, he came second.
Wow.
So well done, Michael.
Well done.
And I know he flies a 737 for a national airline for a living. What amazing success story for the British aerospace sector. So well done, Michael. Okay, we're going to take a break now. And after the break, we're going to talk to Tony from Event Fire Solutions.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
NBC reports that two TSA employees have been fired after they allegedly set up a system to allow a male screener to pat down attractive men going through security at Denver International. The employees were not identified, but there will be no criminal charges because no victims have come forward. You know, they can't assess who was a victim and who wasn't. But here's how it went down. The male screener would give a signal to a female employee when a male passenger arrived that he thought was cute, and she would falsely enter the sex of the passenger as a female. So the machine would report an anomaly that triggered a pat down of a passenger's
groin. So this guy was gay?
Yes.
All right.
And he'd find a hot dude and be like, this one. They'd enter it as a female, and he would give some sort of a physical pat down. She told the TSA investigator she did this for at least 10 times in the past.
You know what I want to say to, like, everyone who's in the TSA? You're working for the TSA. Technically, you're really barely employable.
Like, might as well be backyard boxing and unsanctioned.
Before air travel, you would have no job. This is the bottom rung here. This is when you've run out of things to pursue in life, when every dream has been dashed, when your SAT score had a minus in front of it. This is what you end up doing for a living. This is it, because it's not like you're going to go, you know what? All right, I'm out of here, yeah. And I'm going to invent my own electric SUV. Yeah,
there's no safety net.
Elon Musk, look out! Everybody who works at the airport, whether it's the Cinnabon or the TSA, this is the last stop. There is no place to go. I mean, there's McDonald's. That is it for you.
Tony, welcome to Extended.
Good morning, Peter. Thank you for coming to see us today.
Tony, Eventfire Solutions covers every type of event from rock concerts to air shows. Tell us a little bit about EFS.
EFS was born out of the Olympics initially, where we helped out doing some risk assessments. It now comprises of three directors,
yep.
Myself, Paul and Steve, all serving firefighters, all with a passion of all things aviation. Hence, we've ended up living on an airbase. Our offices are the old mess, and
yeah.
The fire engines are stored in one of the hangars.
And we're at Upper Heyford now. That's where you're based. It used to be called RAF Upper Heyford, but it was an American base.
Yeah, initially, and ironically, we do a lot of parachute work, supporting the RAF in their parachute training. And this was in the 40s, an RAF base.
Yeah.
It was Britain's number one parachute school.
Right.
It then got handed over to the Americans, and they had B-50s, B-58s, going on to Phantoms, and which everyone loves on Extended. I know their passion. And, of course, the F-111s, which left him here to assist with the Tripoli raids.
Yeah, you saw them in my younger days. Tell us a little bit about EFS then and the services you provide, things like airfield support.
Yeah, it all spirals for us. We started off just doing the military work.
Yeah.
But what our job is to protect the people on the ground and to help pilots land. It's the only part that's compulsory coming down.
Yeah.
So we go to a normal airfield and we may upgrade it to assist with bigger aircraft coming in. We'll go to disused airfields for the military. On the civilian side, we'll create helipads, heliports, or, you know, quite often we'll go to a festival that's got grass strip and we'll protect the people landing and taking off, like racetracks for jockeys.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll assist putting fire cover in for those people.
Right. And you also provide fire cover for some of the big air shows and some of the not so big air shows as well. What sort of services do you provide there?
We have a passion for REAT. My godfather was a guy called Roland Ferber, and he died a few years ago, but he was the lead medical officer for REAT. So every year we go there and we volunteer our services.
Yeah.
And we do car park and domestic cover for those guys. And we take a lot of water down and set up for the 3 days. And it's to put something back into the RAF community for us. Yeah. We also do some of they are smaller but bigger in some ways with the likes of Dawlish.
Yeah.
Fantastic air show, one of our favourite. We help those guys out.
And you provide fire cover there?
We provide fire cover for those guys for helipads.
Yeah.
And also in case something wants to take off or land up on the emergency landing strip and things like that if they need it. Then we did Red Bull Air Races, which was a fantastic job for us. We loved doing that for the Red Bull team down at Ascot last year. And we go around doing various other smaller events like old, you know, the supporting the paras, It's So Para, Old Sarum, and Yeah, it's an endless list.
And your background is in the fire service, but airport fire service.
Yeah, I mean, I started my career going way back in the day. I was military. I was in the Duke of Edinburgh's Royal Regiment. I was a foot soldier. And then I went from that and I left the army and worked at Kidlington Airport.
Yeah.
And that was my grounding, which was a fantastic place to be. Fourth busiest airport in the country at the time, as our claim to fame. And busy, because they were all learning. So numerous times we'd have PA-28s and 34s coming in, forgetting to put the wheels down. And, you know, people declaring...
What sort of shouts have you been to then?
I've done it all, really. I've had people that have had... stomach problems
with
single seaters and they've got to come down quick and not always made it, right through to aeroplanes doing mid-air collisions. I went to a couple of those in my whole time career in Oxfordshire Fire and Rescue, and everything between. So I've done the hot brakes down at Riyadh a few years ago when I was at Kidlington on some planes, forgetting to put the wheels down, as I say, picking the props up. We've had 109s coming in with wheels that wouldn't come down, so we've had to build sandbags underneath them so they can land.
So it's a real range.
So you've
got a lot of experience for the job that you do now.
Sadly, too much often. You know, one of the things everyone, have you seen any of the nasty stuff? Yes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, if we never, there wouldn't be any firefighters.
But the whole thing about the services that you provide is also to help people recognise those risks and prevention, in effect. That's a whole part of EFS's service.
EFS risk, yeah. I mean, we go out and we write the risk assessments. We'll sit into the, you know, come with a customer to the SAG meeting, the safety action group, the licensing committees, because we understand actually what risk is.
Yeah.
We understand the terminology that the councils are using, because we're all whole-time serving firefighters. And we're able to put that on paper and say, this is the risk and this is how we mitigate against it.
Yeah.
So Event Fire Solutions is the whole package. We cover events of any description.
Yeah.
We specialise in fire, but we do water rescue, medical and risk assessments.
Yeah.
And then the solutions is we don't bring you problems, we bring you answers.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you're running an event and, you know, a small air show, what happens if there's a car fire? It spreads to 10 cars. How do we mitigate?
Yeah.
What are the rules? The purple guide, the green guides.
Yeah.
And it's our job, the team of us in the office, me, Paul and Steve, to get amongst that.
Right.
We then go out and train. So when we go to the airfields, you know, Shobdon's a great example, one of my favourite little airfields, beautiful up in Hereford area. With those guys, when we're up there protecting or working with the MOD, doing parachute training, we will often take a day out and share our skills with the local airfield.
Right.
And invite them in free of charge and say, come and have a day with us, see what it's like. And we'll give them the skills to make them better.
Right, okay. And just looking at some of the equipment that you've got, what sort of vehicles do you operate and what's your fleet made up of?
It's a really wide-ranging fleet. We've got 4x4s because everything has to be able to go off-road.
Yeah.
And right up to the full-size county standard fire engine.
Right.
The one we're in at the minute is these ex-Warwickshire.
Yeah.
It's served all around Warwickshire County and it's capable of delivering, if you can think about the amount of water, but 2 tonnes of water, that's a massive amount. We can deliver that in 43 seconds.
Wow.
So it's very, very capable vehicle.
And you've got a fleet of ambulances, you've got 4x4s, quite a few 4x4s I've seen. Boats, I've also seen that you've got. It's a very wide range of vehicles for the services you deliver.
Yeah, and it's ever growing. You know, we buy a vehicle that suits. We don't try and make one of our existing fit the problem. If you need a boat, then we need a boat.
Yeah.
And we guarantee 100% resilience with everything we do.
Yeah.
So EFS won't have one boat, of course, it'll have two.
Yeah.
Because if one was to go wrong, the engine was to break. And when we deploy, we did a job in Liverpool, whereby they needed a boat on the locks for the Three Queens event. And in case that let us down, we took a spare with us. So we carried two boats to every job.
And you also need boats for some of the air shows, because some of the aircraft are operating over water as well.
Most certainly, and it's a risk that most people, it's too difficult to draw.
Yeah.
What are we going to do with that? Hopefully the RNLI are available. You know, they're good guys. Yeah. They like to come and help out, and they do a fantastic job in the water. But sometimes we just need that extra swift response. So our ribs are 5.5 metres long with 90 or 100 horsepower engines, so we get there quick.
all of the drivers are YHA qualified, because standards are really important to us.
Yeah.
And every one of us is a Swift Water Rescue technician.
Right.
So we've got all the dry suits to be able to get in, get the person out. We use it for parachute recovery, and we train on that.
Yeah.
We train, but also at festivals, you know, if somebody jumps in or swims out and gets out, they're drunk. Okay. So we have to manage that risk.
Right, okay. So what air shows can we see you at this year?
I think the big two for us, we're going to be at Dawlish.
Yeah.
That's something we're very proud of.
You provide all the emergency cover for Dawlish, don't you?
All the fire cover, We may help them out with some medical this year, because I know they want a little bit of extra help.
Yeah.
So we may do that, but we're definitely doing all the fire cover for them. And Riyadh's the next big one for us.
Right.
So that's the ones where you better spot us. At Riyadh this year, come and see us. We've got a stand on the main aisle.
Okay.
So we're going to be in the place. You'll see one of our trucks. You can come and have pictures done, climb on board. And,
excellent. So do go along if you're listening. Now, we're delighted that Event Fire Solutions decided to support Extended. What attracts you to being involved in this sector?
I think for me is I actually like everything aviation. You know, I love the smell of jet fuel. It's one of those things, for everyone that knows what I'm saying, they'll understand. Being on an airfield, I look around and I just see, I have flashbacks of airplanes flying by me, you know, I feel that. I listen to aviation, you know, and I listen to Extended. And I think we've got to support this industry. We're a small part of a massive industry.
Yeah.
As is Extended, it's a small part. But together, it's a community.
Yeah.
And it's that community. We can do a little bit to help out. We try and encourage people to come along and train with us, and learn about us. And if we can put a little bit back into that world by supporting Extended, then fantastic for us.
It's very noisy at the moment, Tony. We've just jumped into one of the tenders, and we're just going to run around around the airfield. What vehicle are we in, and what's going on? Why is it so noisy?
At the moment, the tanks are recharging, the vehicles are all on standby. The oils are coming up to temperature, because being a fire appliance, it has to be really quick, so everything gets ready before we move.
Right, okay. So we're off. Schoolboy's dream for me.
All of the trucks are automatic.
Right, okay.
Because we have to concentrate on what we're doing. Both hands on the wheel.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got lights and horns to deal with.
Yeah.
And being 17 tonnes in weight and driving fast, we have to do a lot of training.
Yeah.
So all of our drivers go on advanced training courses.
Yeah.
And every 3 years are completely assessed to make sure that they're capable to do the job required.
Okay. And what qualification do you have to do to drive a fire engine on an airfield or on a public road?
On an airfield, we need nothing, because it's private land.
Yeah.
However, every single one of our guys is a whole-time serving firefighter.
Right, okay.
So we know that Monday to Friday, because of the shift patterns, we use them on bank staff basis.
Yeah.
Our guys are fully trained up with HGVs, medicals, and advanced driver training.
Right, okay. So, Tony, we're over the other side of the airfield now. Are these the hardened shelters?
They are. And the ones we're right outside of, for those that know Upper Heyford, you'll notice a double skin wire.
Yep.
And then this is where, during the 90s or early 90s, that the nuclear planes were stored.
Okay.
So the ones in here would have carried nuclear bombs back in, and the stuff that went to Libya, they left here.
Right, okay, that isn't that long ago, is it?
No, and driving around the airbase, it makes you realise how real this was for people.
Yeah.
The thousands of people that worked here every day.
Yeah.
What pleasure we have to be based here.
Yeah, that's amazing. Shame there's nothing flying from here, but it's great to be here and it's great to see.
And it's being protected now. It's going to be a heritage site.
Right.
It will last for a time immemorial, and people will do tours and come and have a look around the site, because actually it's a fantastic reminder of how close we got to real trouble with the Russians during the Cold War.
Yeah.
And who knows, we could go back there with Russia saying today they're going to build new missiles.
That's right. So, Tony, we come into an area that's within one of the double fences. There's lots of concrete and mounds and holes in the ground here. What have we come into here?
We're actually into the bomb dump area, Peter, to have a quick look here.
Right.
And to show you some of the art that still exists that the guys drew on the walls.
Right, okay. And this was where the missiles, bombs, bullets, ammunition was all stored?
Yeah, everything the F-111s needed during the Cold War was based here.
Right.
And thousands and thousands of American soldiers would have spent long days and nights guarding this base.
Right, okay.
You'll see that the signs, it's not great for radio, but the signs are still all over the doors of the explosives.
And they look like big heavy doors as well.
Yeah, and they needed to be. Yeah. Some of the pyrotechnics and explosives in here went right to the top too.
Yeah.
It was never classified as a nuclear base, I don't think.
Right, okay.
But there's no doubt there were nuclear missiles here at times.
Right, okay. And now some of this area has been used for firework storage.
Yes, we have. It's one of the biggest coma sites, which is a technical reference for, you know, a big hazard for us.
Right.
And the site's growing and developing, and brilliant. You know, new life into what would have been a derelict buildings.
Yeah, fantastic.
So, Tony, we're coming to your main area now at the moment on the airfield. What have we got in front of us here in this? What was an old hangar?
Yes, it was the old nose docks, Peter. In front of us, we've got a wealth of equipment. We've got six frontline appliances that we use for going out on aviation support and fates and fairs and festivals. We've got a range of four different ambulance vehicles. And our fire testing equipment and of course our refueling bowsers.
And some boats as well. There's boats in here.
Yeah, we've got water rescue. I mean, aircraft work around water. And we need parachute recovery work that we do for certain people. We've got some of that and we've got some training equipment.
Right.
And vans to go out and service all the equipment. And then the rapid response 4x4s as well.
Okay. And we've got some of those parked outside. But the one that intrigues me is the one with airfield support unit on the front. What vehicle's that?
That's an old Mercedes. It worked at a nuclear power plant for a few years. We picked it up 2 years ago and it's now going through a renovation to become an airfield support unit.
Yeah.
And it was specialised by carrying high volumes of gas. So we don't do any damage to the engines.
Right.
And we'd be able to put up somewhere around about 3,000 litres of CO2 through a ducting system into engine fires without affecting any foam damage.
Right. Now, a bit of a numpty, Tony, in this sort of thing. I just assumed it being an airfield support unit, it'd have foam.
Yeah, absolutely. Foam's fantastic. One of the things for us is when we teach, we can do that. We meet all the regulations under the CAA and of course, the MAA would have in the foam. But when you own the aircraft, if I put foam in your engine because it's got a flame, that ruins the engine.
Right.
If I put CO2 through it, perhaps we can save the engine for it to be repaired.
Right.
So one of the things for us is being dynamic on the fire ground. Yes, we'll save savable life using foam straight away, primary media. But if we can, we've got an engine fire, let's extinguish it, just get the pilot to shut down, extinguish using CO2.
Yeah.
And that way we can just make sure the aircraft flies another day.
What do these four tenders do? What's their capabilities?
They all carry 2 tons of water, which is phenomenal. You know, it's getting mass water to the fire ground quickly for us. They're all foam tenders, so they are built in foam and can all deliver, you know, a few thousand litres of foam quite quickly. We use them as troop transporters, as being able to get the fire crew to the ground to carry. They're big toolboxes, really, Peter, and they're full of ladders to help us get stuff out of trees or climb up onto engine mounts. They're carrying the equipment to take things apart.
Yeah.
And really, they're frontline appliances that you'd find in any county service.
And at an airfield where potentially you're providing cover, because you provide cover for the MOD, for private functions, for private aircraft and all sorts of things like that. What would one of these appliances be crewed with? How many people and what sort of capabilities do they need to have?
You know, it really depends on the aircraft and the type of cover that's required.
Yeah.
For example, if we're on a little Robinson two-seater, we can get away with one of our 4x4s. We need to go low-intensity H1 category.
Yeah.
Each category requires different amount of water and people.
Right.
And for us to comply, we have to bring out as the categories get higher, we need to bring more water, more foam, more people to be able to deal with any incidents.
So if I was flying a biz jet, something like that, what would you need to provide to cover for that?
If you're flying it for yourself, probably nothing. Because it's your aircraft, you own it, you can do whatever you want. You have a responsibility to land your aircraft safely on a private strip. If you start carrying passengers, then you're looking at the fuselage width. So if we said we cover up to Cat 3, Yeah. It goes from 1 to 10. So Heathrow's Cat 10.
Yeah.
General Aviation, the small puddle jumpers, we're down at Cat 1.
Right.
And it builds up progressively. 3.5 metre fuselage, we're looking at Cat 3. So it does build up. And each one brings with that. Cat 3, for example, we would take a crew of five. We'd need four, but we take a fifth person for incident command. Right down at the General Aviation, low Cat 1, with its best goodwill, volunteers, not a lot of training.
Yeah.
They do a fantastic job, and something's better than nothing, and it comes down to a cost basis. But if you're actually paying as a passenger, you expect to land in a safe environment.
Yeah.
And that's what we do. We come in and we will either help an airfield go up in category, so we take a Cat 1 to a Cat 3, or we go to a disused airfield, or at a festival where they want to use helicopters or a racetrack, then we'll come in and set up a safe system of work for everybody there.
We've just come over to the other side of the hangar, and there's a white, will I call this a Bowser?
It is. It's a 1,000-litre Bowser, or 950 litres to be correct. That keeps us under ADR rules, and it's something we take out for film shoots and for pleasure flights where we can refuel helicopters on the ground.
Right,
jet fuel only.
Yep.
And our guys are fully trained on the test, and they know how to work it and deliver it. We turn up, we take a problem where it saves a lot of money for people, because if you have to send the helicopter off to refuel, you lose flying time and downtime on the film shoot. Whereas we come in, do the fire cover, allow the aircraft to land, take off, and refuel at the same time.
Right. And what capacity's this got for carrying fuel?
It can carry 950 litres.
Right, okay.
And we lose a little bit for testing.
Yeah.
But really, that will keep the aircraft flying for a good day on a helicopter.
Right, okay. Love the smell.
Yeah, it's absolutely. It's one of the perks of the job.
So what are we going to see here, Tony?
This is part of our live fire training. We go out and show companies how to fight fires.
Yep.
Everyone's mandatory in every business have fire extinguisher training.
Yep.
But most people do it with a PowerPoint. Well, we don't do that. Okay. You don't learn to fight fires on a computer.
Yeah.
We bring a real fire to you
right,
at the same price as your PowerPoint and allow you to train properly. And we're going to get you to
I'm slightly nervous.
Yeah, well, we're going to light up some flames.
Okay.
So there's our first flame.
Right. Right, gosh, fire.
Okay. We're going to light some more up here.
Okay. Gosh. Oh, yeah, okay. So basically, I've got a grill in front of me. There's fire coming from the top, the bottoms, all over. I wouldn't want to be in this place.
And a fire like this, Peter, is a typical bin fire on a carpet, just spread a little tiny bit.
Yeah.
Most people run away.
Yeah.
What we're going to do now is we're going to train you.
Okay.
Live on this radio.
live on extended. I'm going to put a fire out. I'm going to put the recorder down to one side.
So I need you to hold it like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So you go hold the one. I'm going to demonstrate first. Put one hand like that, one like that. You position that. Okay.
Yeah.
And we're going to press it, and to press it one go.
Okay.
So pull the pin out.
Okay. Okay.
Mate, get ready for the noise.
Oh, it's a lot easier than I thought, actually.
I took it off.
Oh, okay.
But it's
quite intimidating, isn't it, the fire?
Fire is.
Yeah.
People should be afraid of fire.
Yeah.
People die in fires every year.
Yeah.
That's why we take our profession really seriously.
Yeah.
If we're training, we train on real fire.
Yeah. Okay.
If we're teaching, we teach with real fire.
Yeah.
So you can actually feel the heat as you walk forward.
Yeah.
Dealing with the noise of the extinguisher. That on its own is quite daunting for people that have never used one.
Yeah.
So everybody that comes with us, works with us, trains with us, or employs us is all on hands-on, because we believe that's the best way to learn. You know, at some point you come out of the simulator and you get onto the real aircraft.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're the same in fire, Peter. It's a big part of what we do.
Tony, where can we find out about Event Fire Solutions online?
We are big online. We spend a lot of time online. You'll quickly find us. Event Fire Solutions is on Facebook.
Yeah.
Just type it in the search bar. We'll come up.
Yeah.
We're on Twitter at @fire_event, and also on our website, and that will link you through to everything we do, which is eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Tony, thank you very much for supporting us and thanks for having us here today.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Pete, and we hope to see you again soon.
Okay, I've got a confession to make. Tony did offer the steering wheel of the fire tender to me to race down the old runway at Upper Hayford, and I bottled it. All my kids' dreams of being a firefighting, a fireman and driving a fire engine got the chance, and I was like, oh, I'm too nervous.
Listeners, if you dial 999 and Peter Johnson answers the phone, go and get yourself a bucket of water.
Great guy, great team, lovely to have them on board. But what a great service they provide. You don't think of small airfields that don't have permanent fire and emergency support needing that sort of thing. And today, as we record, was the Formula One race at Silverstone, and they were providing the emergency and fueling for the helicopters going in and out. So what a great little business.
It sounded like you'd been, sort of, sort of witness to some interesting and, incidents. There was something like a 109 when we had to put the sunbags down, which presumably is not a Messerschmitt 109. I think he was probably talking about a helicopter.
Well, that was me. Do you know what? I didn't ask him that question because I did think it was a 109. But there you go.
It's been great to kind of go driving around the Upper Hayford in a big fire truck and see all those old sort of F111 sort of hardened aircraft shelters and all the rest of it.
Yeah. To see some of the stuff there, and he made a few comments on air that you heard about the fact that it wasn't supposed to be a nuclear or on occasion wasn't supposed to be holding nuclear weapons, but it obviously was. But yes, it's not that long ago, Upper Hayford. I can remember going to see him put the fingers through the fence, watch the F-111s going off from there. So sad it's gone, but great to have EFS on board. So thank you very much, Tony, and we're looking forward to working with you over the coming months. Okay, we're going to take a quick break now, and we're going to come back and talk to Martin O'Connell. Martin is a project manager at AAMI. And his job is designing new airport infrastructure, things like taxiways and runways. So we hear Martin after the break.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Well, after less than 10 minutes in the air, an Alaska Airlines flight was forced to make an emergency landing on Monday when a napping baggage handler woke up in the plane's cargo hold and started banging and screaming, according to Docker.
I take back everything I said.
Today, I'm at AAMI and I'm with Martin. Martin, welcome to Extended.
Thanks, Peter, for having me.
Martin, before we talk a little bit about your job and about some of the projects and airport infrastructure, tell me a little bit about AAMI and its airport infrastructure team.
There's about 20 of us here based in Crawley, and we're a group of civil engineers, electrical engineers, and airfield planners. And we work across a range of airports and locations in the UK, designing runways, taxiways, aircraft pavements, stands, airfield lighting and just the whole spatial and geometry of the airports.
Right, okay, quite interesting then, because we want to learn a little bit more about what goes on behind some of these projects. Tell me a little bit about your career though. How did you get to sit at this table and design Heathrow Airport's runways?
Well, funny enough, I mean, I started off growing up as a kid wanting to be a pilot, and I kind of got to the point where I wasn't able to do that, to follow those dreams. But I also had this kind of interest in construction and engineering as I was growing up. I was a fanatic of Lego.
Yeah.
And that sort of kind of grew in tandem with my interest in aviation. When that point came that I couldn't become a pilot, I decided it was time to go and, you know, follow that other aspect of my interest, which was the civil engineering side. When I did my degree and master's degree, I finished and I still wanted to pursue that area. And one of the things that was quite big at the time in Europe, despite the recession, was the construction of Terminal 2 at Heathrow.
Yeah.
So I followed that dream and went to Heathrow and worked for Ferrovial.
Yeah.
And from there, I worked on site. I was part of the team that delivered and built the aircraft parking stands at Terminal 2.
Right.
So that was quite an interesting start to my civil engineering career.
Well, let's talk about some of the projects that you've worked on. One of the things I want to understand a little bit more about is how does one go about designing and then implementing something like an aircraft stand and an airport runway or taxiway?
Well, there's a number of steps to kind of initially follow. First of all, you need to discuss and talk with the airports as to what sort of traffic they're expected at the airport, what size aircraft. That's the movements, the type of aircraft, the size of the aircraft. That's very important. We need to find out how many of those we can fit in a certain area of the airport. So that's kind of where our planning team kind of comes in at the very start. They kind of fit the aircraft into the areas that the airport want them to be in.
Yeah.
And from that point on, then the civil engineering team, the electrical engineering teams get involved. The civil team will start figuring out and determining the weights of the aircraft that are going to use that. From that, then we can figure out the depth of the pavements, the likely construction makeup, what materials we're going to be using. And what sort of paint markings, etc., we're going to put on on that surrounding area. That's sort of the, you know, the parking element of it, your car park element of it. There's also a number of ancillary services that go along with an aircraft parking stand or indeed a taxiway or a runway. A lot of that is the electrical infrastructure, the stand entry guidance, the boarding bridges, and any of the fixed electrical ground power that you'll often see the aircraft being plugged in at the head of the stand.
And
all that is what we package up and deliver to the airports that we work with.
Right, okay. And how regulated is the work that you have to do? I'm assuming there's standards for everything. On an airfield, how different are they from other civil engineering projects?
Well, in the airport pavement sector particularly, there's quite a lot of common things with the highways code and the highways industry. A lot of the specifications and standards we use, you know, if you're working in both areas, you'll find commonalities with them. Having said that, from a pure spatial and geometry perspective of an airport, there are a number of restrictive elements that we've got to consider.
Yeah.
And a lot of those standards are available from the CAA, Civil Aviation Authority, the CAA. But also there are, you know, specific elements within even pavement design that we have to follow that are airport specific. A lot of the standards we'll follow are from the Defense Infrastructure Organization, part of the MOD. That's a lot of the stuff that we would design would be based on their specifications. But if we're working for a larger company, say like Heathrow Airport or Gatwick Airport, they have their own internal specifications that we will work to and with. So and then we kind of garner knowledge from other areas of the world as well that are quite good at airport design. The FAA in particular has a wealth of information about airport design, pavement construction, electrical infrastructure. It's all out there, and we use information from all over the world to do what we do.
Okay, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the projects you've worked on. But those standards, I mean, America has different electrical standards and things like that. Can you bring that sort of best practice over? Is that the sort of thing you're looking at, or are you looking at new ideas, new concepts and things like that?
It's sort of in areas where there may be a bit of a gray element in a design perspective. We might look for guidance to see what the FAA does in a particular scenario, just to make sure that we are designing to best practice, that we're not straying outside the realms of engineering norms. And that's sort of the, you know, the areas that we will look to other standards and agencies for. But generally speaking, what's available to us here in the UK is very comprehensive and quite in depth.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk about some of the projects then that you've worked on. Although we're sitting not a few minutes away from Gatwick Airport, let's start with Heathrow. And of course, there is some connections there between Ferrovial and AAMI, but the work you do is in your own right as the AAMI Infrastructure Airport team. Let's talk about some of those projects then. The Southern Runway and some of the taxiways you've worked on. Obviously, Heathrow's looking to do some massive expansion, but it's been through an awful lot of work very recently to just get it fit for purpose now and to make that experience good. Can you tell us a little about some of the projects you've worked on there?
Well, it's probably good to give it just a little background. Since T5 was built, the airport's been transforming a lot since then.
Yeah.
Some of what this team did before I joined it was actually realigning and designing some of the new taxiways around Heathrow to go with this infrastructure that's going to be built over the next few years, or has been built since T5. From a personal perspective, I've been involved in the two rehabilitations of the runways at Heathrow, the north and the southern runway.
What does rehabilitation mean of an airport runway?
Rehabilitation is effectively looking at the runway and going, what condition is it in, and what has to be done for it to function properly going forward.
Right.
That's on a very rudimentary point of view. But effectively what we did at this junction at Heathrow was we determined that the main runways and the pavement we needed to plane off a bit of the asphalt that was on top of the runway, about 50 millimeters of it.
Right.
The surface condition of it was relatively poor, comparatively speaking, of course, but the runway is operational. It wasn't falling apart. And these rehabilitations occur about once a decade. So this time around, we planed off 50 millimeters of the original surface and replaced it.
Yeah.
But in tandem with that, there is a replacement of the electrical infrastructure that went around both runways, the airfield lighting and the cabling as well that went with it. So specifically with the airfield lighting, we changed from tungsten halogen lamps.
Right.
To LED lights.
And that's very new in the sector, isn't it? The use of LED lighting. I know we've seen it around the world sort of come on leaps and bounds, but it was quite untested until quite recently, wasn't it?
Relatively speaking, it's a new aspect to airport operations. Mm. There is quite a difference in terms of outright costs to purchase and install the LEDs. But they do have a longer lasting life.
Yeah.
And for an airport the size of Heathrow, it's a bit of a no-brainer to spend that money at the start so that your ongoing costs are a lot less. If you're working at a smaller airport that might not actually have the lights turned on a regular basis, then that outright cost might not be justified. So there's still a marketplace for both the old-fashioned tungsten halogen lamps and the LEDs going forward.
Okay, I'll come back to the runway. Just another question on the lighting then. How different is the actual luminosity? Not quite sure what the word is there. The strength of the lighting is very different, LED and tungsten, of course. What sort of challenges do you have there in terms of measuring that sort of thing?
In terms of luminosity, being a civil engineer, I wouldn't know the ins and outs of the electrical side of it. But from a pure, enthusiast perspective, or someone who'd be walking past the airport on a daily basis and might notice a difference, what you'll definitely see is the intensity of the light.
Yeah.
It's a lot sharper. The colors are more true.
Yeah.
For example, a tungsten halogen white light will actually give off this sort of yellow hue, similar to your kitchen bulb from years ago. But the change to LED is particularly strong in terms of the white color.
Yeah.
It's very pure. It's very sharp. It's very, very distinct. You might even see it when you're approaching an airport as a passenger. You'll be coming in on the base leg, and you may see, the lights are very intense compared to what you may have noticed previously.
Right. Okay. And for what it's worth, pilots who now fly into the LED zones say they much prefer it. It's much clearer. So obviously, it has that beneficial. Yeah, that's right. Let's come back then to talk about the runways and the rehabilitation. I want to understand a bit more then about how do you manage that process of closing the airport, in effect, to take that surface off, relay that surface and open that runway again. What sort of pressures and challenges are involved in that?
it's quite an operation, but when you go out there and view it, you almost wonder how, you know, it appears very easy,
yeah.
But it's just the guys and the contractors and the teams that are doing this. This is their day job or night job, yeah. As it would be.
Yeah.
This is what they're used to. They wouldn't have won the contract to do it unless it was something that they were, yeah. They had quite a reputation for. At Heathrow, basically at 10:30 at night, the airport goes down to a one runway operation, single runway operation, where you'll have arrival and departures on one runway.
Yeah.
At that point, the teams just literally invade that closed runway to the section that they want to resurface at that point. The first group of people to go out will be those setting up the site. That'll just be setting up the site boundaries and the area that the workers will be working at that point.
Yeah.
And the machinery that'll first go out are what's called the planers. They're the ones that'll line themselves up and start actually tearing up that 50 millimeters of surface to get rid of it and put it back into the wagons for recycling or other uses. Yeah. And they'll leave this surface that's 50 millimeters planed off. It looks quite rough. And then... in a more rudimentary term, it'll be ready in a few hours for that new 50 millimeters of asphalt to go down.
Right.
And that's on a very simple level as to what's done.
And does the surface go back that very night as well? Obviously, you can't leave the runway open.
Correct.
I don't mean open. I mean closed, but open to the elements.
No, the surface goes back that evening. It takes laying starts at about 1 o'clock in the morning. Having opened at 10:30 or closed at 10:30 for your initial preparations, that'll continue on until about 4 or 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
At which point your new surface is down, the temporary paint markings are replaced for that section that's been removed and replaced.
And are you not replacing the whole runway length? You do it in parts, do you?
Correct. That's probably something I should have explained. No, so okay. on a runway that's as long as Heathrow's, which is in the region of 3,500 meters, what will be standard is about 80 to 90 meters per night of the runway will be replaced.
Right.
So it happens over a 3 to 4 month time period that this process occurs. So it's very step by step.
Yeah.
And the teams work their way along the runway piecemeal until they eventually complete it.
On my novice knowledge of this, then, does that not leave bumps? How do you seal the bumps? You know, are they not bumps, or am I going to feel that as a passenger?
Absolutely not. No, everything is put back almost exactly as it was.
Yeah.
Once the asphalt is put down, there's a team of an army of rollers that roll the surface back to its original condition. The surface is cooled down relatively quickly by the time the airport's reopening at about 6 o'clock in the morning for arriving flights. And there's absolutely no issues with aircraft trafficking that so soon after it's been relayed.
And does this need to be done in the summer when it's in theory in this country a little drier, not always, but and light is better?
In theory, the best time of the year is to do it in the spring, summer and early autumn, but there's absolutely nothing stopping you going through the winter. The only problems you may have are weather stoppages. You won't get that productivity in the winter months, but sometimes particularly with the smaller airports when they may only have one runway, that nighttime period may be relatively busy with incoming charters up to maybe 2 in the morning and outgoing charters at maybe 5 in the morning. So there isn't that time period to do your work. So they may not want you to close the runway during the summer period, which is their busiest.
Yeah.
So quite often you may find that you'll be restricted to doing your work in the winter months when they do have that working period.
Right.
And it's just a case of making sure that the materials you're using are performing as expected and laid as expected. And that all the standards are adhered to going forward. It requires probably a little bit more, inspections and analysis going forward to make sure that what you're putting down is sufficiently acceptable.
What do you need to go and work on that airfield, you know, for yourself in terms of protective equipment and that sort of thing? You're on site watching this contractor. What do you have to take with you? And I suppose the question I just want to ask you to wrap up this bit with is, who signs it off?
Well, who signs it off is a pretty tricky one, and particularly with Heathrow. There's a variety of people. But in terms of the equipment that we go out with, it'd be probably be no different from anyone that you would see on a construction site in the city centre or in a railway. You may think that's a little unusual, that given that it's a strip of pavement with no buildings around it. Nonetheless, everyone is subjected to the same safety standards in the industry, and there's no exceptions for airports and runways.
So how do you hand it over? Who takes responsibility for opening that runway to probably the transatlantic flights and the early arrivals?
I mean, ultimately, it's down to the airport operations to give the AOK as to whether that runway is acceptable. Having said that, the contractor on site also has the responsibility to make sure that the product that he's handing over is going to work and will be acceptable for airport trafficking. So there are a number of people who are involved in that handover process, and everyone has to be satisfied that it is good to go and that it is safe for those 747s and A380s to land on early in the morning.
Okay, Martin, that's really fascinating to see how an airport's runway like Heathrow's is reconstructed in effect. But you've got a big project on at the moment, Cambridge Airport. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing there.
Yeah, Peter, people might actually be surprised to find out Cambridge actually does have an airport.
Oh, it's a big airport.
It's not too far from Stansted, actually, but no, it's a privately run airfield, and it's business is mainly aircraft maintenance.
Yeah.
So effectively, the runway and the infrastructure of the airport is the driveway for the airport's business. At the moment, we're actually designing, or we're just wrapping up design on the runway resurfacing and rehabilitation at Cambridge Airport. It's the first time the runway since it was constructed has actually undergone a major rehabilitation of its surface. And in tandem with that, we're actually building a brand new taxiway off the runway to an existing aircraft hangar for additional aircraft to use and increase business for the airport.
Yeah. Now, just in terms of the aircraft types, we are talking about everything from light aircraft up to heavy aircraft, aren't we? So in terms of the technical aspects of what you need to do, I suppose those taxiways and runways need to be able to take those heavy loads.
Absolutely. I mean, at Cambridge Airport, the runway is actually quite short. But having said that, because their primary business is maintenance, they do get a lot of maintenance business from the likes of BA and other airlines within Europe. So you do get those heavy aircraft. What will happen, though, is those heavy aircraft actually leave quite light. So that's another aspect you got to take into account. So yes, you may get a 777 coming in, and you may think, yes, that's a heavy aircraft, we got to account for that. But because the runway is so short, it'll actually depart very light and might only have a ferry flight to Heathrow, which is 25 minutes at max, probably.
Yeah.
So in that respect, we look at the design of the pavements and we take that into account. Where are the likely destinations that you can fly from Cambridge? What are the weights of the aircraft corresponding to that? Yeah. And then you design your pavement thickness around those restrictions.
Right.
So that applies to both the runway resurfacing element of it and then the design and build of the brand new taxiway.
Right, okay. And is that taxiway being built on, I suppose I could describe it as virgin land? Do you have to do the surveys of the geology and what's underneath it and all those sorts of things?
Effectively, yes. It's being built alongside an existing taxiway, which is now being abandoned.
Yeah.
So it's currently built on what is virgin ground. The surveys and geotechnical investigations that would have been required for that design were already provided within the tender package that came with the job.
Right, okay.
So that information was already available to us. What we do then is we bring that into our engineering design realm and take all that information out of it and go about our pavement design. Again, we'll use whatever standards the airport has requested within their tender documentation, whether it's the MOD Defence Estates Infrastructure Standards or it could be another standard. All that sort of stuff is made available to us. If we require any further information, we'll ask the contractor or the airport at the time to fill in those gaps.
A question that popped into my mind then when you talked about the MOD, they use aircraft with high exhaust temperatures for some of their aircraft. Do you have to apply anything in terms of engineering design to that sort of specification?
it's probably worth bearing in mind that us as a team don't delve into too much MOD work and aircraft specific to the MOD, like Tornados or Eurofighters. But having said that, it is an element that, yes, you would have to consider. The high temperatures that come off the engines and the afterburners are relatively low to the ground compared to some of the other aircraft. And what you will see is degradation of the pavement, of the asphalt surfacing underneath that over a long period of time. So what you'll actually find in a lot of the MOD and the RAF bases is that the starter strips and the end portions of the runway, because we use both ends of the runway, might be built in concrete, which is a lot more durable to that sort of thing, whereas the rest of the runway might be built in asphalt.
So that's
an element of it that... It helps counteract those problems. And the fact as well that building the ends of those runways in concrete counteracts the problems we'll find of aircraft sitting on asphalt for a long time.
You could be waiting to line up.
You end up getting depressions over a period of time underneath the tires. And that could be a problem going forward. So building it in concrete at the beginning and the ends does help that problem. But it's not to say you can't do it in asphalt going forward.
Okay. So where are we with the Cambridge design, or are we in construction yet?
We're in construction. The runway resurfacing is almost complete. And the taxiway has been built. It is yet to be opened. And at the same time, we've actually upgraded the airfield lighting at the same time and the drainage surrounding the airport. So we're probably about 75% to 80% through the project.
And is it all going well?
So far, so good. And touch wood, that continues going forward.
I know you said to me off air that it's consuming all your time.
It is consuming all my time. I've been involved in the project since about January of 2014 or a little bit before it, and the tender process was quite long and extended, but we got to the point where the contract was awarded, and going through with that contract, everything began to just take off very quickly. The design had to be delivered exponentially almost.
When will the airfield be handed back to Cambridge Airport as complete?
As complete, it's planned to hand back, I believe, in the autumn at some point. There are some elements that, you know, we need to figure out how we're going to, you know, finish off. But for all intents and purposes, we can say the autumn it'll be hand back ready for full service.
Okay. Well, let's just wrap up then on one of my favourites, Southampton. It's where I fly from quite often, and I was there a few years ago doing some feature episodes on there. But you've done a fair bit of work on helping them to modernise the airfield.
Yeah, Southampton have actually been quite a good client over the last few years. For such a small airport, they have a lot of small schemes on a recurring basis that need attention. One of the ones that I probably would have been involved in, and it was a scheme design about a year and a half ago, was looking at the current stand parking arrangements at Southampton and looking to modifying that to incorporate slightly larger aircraft. I think at the time the airport was trying to encourage business from another carrier who had larger aircraft compared to Flybe, who are basically the single operator from the airport. So what we did is we looked at the space and the strength of the pavement that was already built at Southampton, and how could we fit in Airbus A320 and A319 aircraft into an area that's currently earmarked for Embraer 195s and 175s. And that was an interesting little project. It's a pure geometrical exercise, and it's a case of pretend parking, for want of a better phrase, all these variety of aircraft in different locations to find them in the optimum configuration. And at the end of the day, we did come up with a solution that allowed both A319 and A320 aircraft to share the same parking stand arrangements and areas as the current Embraer 195. So the airport didn't lose capability to take Embraer 195s, but in actual fact, it gained the ability to take the larger aircraft.
It's fascinating stuff. We've got a long list of other projects I'd love to talk to you about, but we're just running out of time at the moment, Martin. Where can we find out a bit more about Amy and the airport infrastructure team online?
If you go to amy.co.uk, there is a whole section on the website. You'll find it somewhere there, where our team is described, our projects and our services that are available.
Okay, we'll put some links to that in the show note. And also Amy's on Twitter as well, Amy PLC.
Correct.
Martin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Peter, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
It's fascinating stuff to hear how runways are resurfaced. I suppose it's not dissimilar to the motorways and the roads we're used to. But of course, they have to do it overnight, and that runway has to be up and operating the next morning. I've got to say, big cojones to get that done at Heathrow and have the responsibility of opening it the next morning.
I mean, just listening to that, it put some things into context. I was watching a program on Heathrow a couple of weeks ago. And one of the very interesting things there was a overnight runway resurfacing, where all these vehicles and tarmac heavy machinery all lined up, all waiting. I mean, it's great kind of filming, but all waiting for the last aircraft to land. And as soon as that last aircraft landed, they all kind of pulled out onto the runway and got sort of like tearing it up and resurfacing it and putting new car concrete tarmac down and what have you, and then there was a race to do it before the first aircraft sort of turned up, and then it started raining. But what a job, because if you did have something that broke or something that did go down, I mean, holding up Heathrow's morning traffic, all these aircraft, all the big long range stuff coming in from Asia or elsewhere, that would be that would not be a good day.
No, that wouldn't be.
If that was the rail company, they'd just overrun and delay everybody, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. Just...
It's a zero tolerance environment there, isn't it, for any sort of failure. So thanks, Martin, for giving us that little behind the scenes look at designing new airport infrastructure. Martin tells me that when we were debriefing afterwards, he tells me he has a lot of knowledge on the industry in Ireland, so we may well do a feature someday on Irish aviation, and we'll bring Martin back for that. Okay, we'll take a quick break, and after the break, Tim, we're coming back to you.
This is a message for wives and girlfriends of aircraft enthusiasts. Ladies, we all know your other half has got far too many aviation books and magazines, cluttering up far too much space. So here is a brilliant solution. Encourage him to read The Aviation Historian. You see, it's a journal, a sort of cross between a magazine and a book. So it combines the two, and it's compact format, a bit like National Geographic, so it takes up less space. And it's quarterly, not monthly, so it takes up even less space still. And of course, it will keep him happily occupied for ages. It's not in the shops, so check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, and give yourself some space at last.
They don't have no, the room you go in, no club when you get out the plane. You going to get your bag. You ain't stopping.
No.
It ain't no hors d'oeuvres or nothing before you get on the plane.
No, their executive lounge is called the Chili's at the other end of the terminal.
Yeah, you want some Chili's?
It's funny because if you go to LAX, Alaskan hasn't quite committed to an executive lounge, but they piggyback their on somebody else's. Like, we're not quite good enough. Yeah.
Who's their big brother? Who's Alaska's big brother?
It's LAX. I feel like they've teamed up with somebody.
I can see in my mind. I'm going to say United or Continental. I'm going to say Continental.
Yeah. Have you been to the Alaskan? It's great.
I rode Alaska when I go to Alaska.
No, but have you gone to the lounge?
No, I haven't been to the Alaska lounge.
Oh, you got to try the whale blubber. And then they take that big seal skin and they throw you in the air. They all gather around and they throw you in the air.
Yeah, I was disappointed in the lounge. I paid $50 upgrade one time to go in the lounge, and I was not impressed.
Oh, you paid?
I had to pay because I hadn't got the points yet. I hadn't got the points yet, so I had to pay to come in the lounge. But that's what they're doing now. They charge for everything.
When I used to fly from L.A. to New York, somebody would buy me that first-class ticket, and then I would go in the lounge. I'd go, I got a first-class ticket to New York. And they go, sir, it's only for international travel. And I'd go, all right, so listen to me. If I'm in JFK and I'm flying to Heathrow, that's the same flight.
Six-hour
it's the
flight.
Same six yep. hours. It's the same price. It's the same thing. That's first class. But L.A. to New York, which is a six-hour flight, the same distance, the same price, that's not – you can't – what – it doesn't make any sense because it's just about jet fuel and it's just about time in the air. And by the way, I have a first class flight across the country. Can I get a couple cheese squares and a glass of generic wine. Like, really? Is that really going to bankrupt this company?
And did that kind of sweet-talking work on them?
No.
No, they didn't break from the flow chart.
Later, they corrected that. Mm-hmm. They said L.A. to New York, New York to L.A. Cross-country or international. Yep. So they did their own math that I helped for them.
On
the Rosa Parks of first-class lounges.
Oh, well, I can go in
Thank
tomorrow.
Thank you.
Okay, and this week's extended top 10. This episode, we're going to take a look at the top 10 Russian combat aircraft. Ooh. Which comes out on top, comrade. With apologies for my poor pronunciation and in advance of Russian names. At number 10, the Polikarpov Po-2. Who knew an old biplane from 1928 could be so deadly? Flown under darkness by female pilots, the Po-2s of the Night Witches caused sleepless nights for German invaders in World War II, a harassment role repeated in jet-age Korea in 1950. Fun fact, it was still in production until 1952. At number 9, the MiG-25. The USSR's answer to how to catch an SR-71 was this monster Mach 3 interceptor, the MiG-25 Foxbat. Built from steel, the MiG-25 had a max speed of 3.2, which damaged the engines, and could fly at 90,000 feet. Fun fact, the existence of such a super-secret, super-fast Soviet fighter inspired the Craig Thomas novel Firefox, which appeared only a year after a Russian pilot had defected in a MiG-25 to the west. At number 8, the Sikorsky Ilya Muromets. In the First World War, Russia was pioneering strategic bombing with the ahead of its time Sikorsky Ilya Muromets. Built incredibly in 1913 as a luxury airline, this four-engine aircraft with an enclosed cockpit was the largest aircraft of its day and was pressed into service as a bomber on the Eastern Front in World War I. At number 7, the PE-2. Remarkably, as a light bomber, Russia's equivalent to the Mosquito was designed by Vladimir Petrikov while in a gulag, having been sent there under Stalin's orders. Produced in greater numbers than any other twin-engine combat aircraft in World War II except the Junkers 88 in Wellington, the PE-2 also served as a heavy fighter and reconnaissance aircraft. At number 6, the Tupolev Tu-160. Russia's deadliest strategic bomber today, the Tu-160 Blackjack is the heaviest combat aircraft in the world, bigger and faster than its American swing rival, the B-1B. Only 16 of the Tu-160s were built, although Russia is now reported to be mulling restarting production of this nuclear-capable bomber. At number 5, the MiG-29. Russia's MiG-29 Fulcrum came as a massive shock to the West when it was revealed in the 1980s. A highly agile dogfighter, it was also equipped with a helmet-mounted sight and air-to-air missiles that were a generation beyond its field in the West. Aviation. Once the Berlin Wall came down, it was also flown briefly by the newly united Luftwaffe. Fun fact, upgraded over the years, the latest version is the MiG-29K naval fighter, in service with the Indian and Russian navies. At number 4, the Tupolev Tu-95, the big bad bear.
Get involved now coming to a coastline near you, since 1950s,
the four-engine turboprop Tu-95 bomber and maritime reconnaissance aircraft has been an iconic symbol of Cold War and now post-Cold War Russian air power. Fun fact, the tips of the Tu-95's contra-rotating propeller blades reach supersonic speeds and can be heard by the pilots of fighters sent to intercept it, even through helmets. Now, number 3, Sukhoi Su-27 family. If the MiG-29 was a shock to NATO, then Sukhoi's Su-27 family was another heart attack to Western defense analysis. A large, heavily armed, multi-role fighter with amazing agility. With advanced aerodynamics, it caused jaws to drop at air shows with Pugachev's Cobra, an aerobatic move that caused the aircraft to almost stop in mid-air. Now upgraded with more advanced avionics and radars, the Su-27 /30/35 is still the threat aircraft that Western fighters have to beat. At number 2, the Ilyushin Il-2 Sturmovik. Described as vital to the Red Army as bread by Stalin, the ground attack Il-2 Sturmovik and its successor, the Il-10, was the most produced aircraft in World War II, with 42,330 built. Coming into service in 1941, it helped turn the tide of the war by beating back Germany from the gates of Moscow. Heavily armed with 23mm and 37mm cannon, rockets and bombs, the Il-2 was armoured for ground attack and was nicknamed the Flying Tank. Fun fact, ironically, despite the thousands built, only one flyable Il-2 exists today in the US with a US-built engine. And at number 1, what is the ultimate Russian combat aircraft? It's the MiG-21. the most produced supersonic jet fighter in history. Ubiquitous and seeing service with 60 countries, it held its own against more advanced US fighters in Vietnam and has been progressively upgraded. Still in service today with some countries, its low visual signature and high maneuverability means it is still a threat to be respected, especially equipped with high off-ball sight missiles, heavy-mounted sight and EW jammers. It's a jet age classic. And that's my top 10 Russian combat aircraft.
Very good.
Brilliant.
Very good. Enjoyed that. Enjoyed that. Tim, I've got to say, I've never heard of the Miramet.
It's it.
Number eight.
It's before its time. You know, it had luxurious kind of 1913. People were building a four-engined, you know, sort of airliner with, luxury kind of sort of leather interior and all the rest of it. You know.
Yeah. But yeah, agree. Can't disagree with the MiG-21 being number one. Can't. Just can't.
It's a jet age kind of hot rod. You know, I think it's probably the Russian equivalent to the F-104 possibly, or even the Phantom.
Yeah. Oh, got to be the Phantom. What about you, Gareth?
I think you can. You know what? It's hard to argue the case against the MiG-21, but I do think there's others that have got a good shot at this X-10 title. For me, and I'm guessing for quite a few people of a certain generation, MiG-29 will always be a bit special because of them appearing in the West and the shot, you know, as you rightly said, Tim, that really resonated with people, and it was the first time we saw people like, you know, Anatoly Kovachur, the test pilot, and stuff like that. So that will always be a bit special. But it's you know, I'm not gonna argue against it. Disappointing that the incredible Yak Forger wasn't on the list.
Ooh. Oh yeah.
I mean that's a technological,
it was a bit rubbish, wasn't it?
Was it 30 minutes or 20 minutes flight time, something like that?
Yeah.
Apparently there was even one kind of the VTOL fighter that was the kind of Soviet equivalent of the Harrier. Apparently, at one point, I think there was even a pilot's mutiny because they wouldn't fly because it was so so dangerous. Although the ejection seats saved a lot of pilots, you know, that but its utility, yeah.
And for anyone who wants to, particularly the MiG-21, but I think we've mentioned this before, books like Red Eagles about the Americans flying. MiG-17s, 19s, 21s, MiG-23. I mean, that MiG-23, the Flogger is probably another classic. But there's some really good stuff out there about actually operating these aircraft from a pilot's and a maintainer's perspective. And you can go and hunt for some of those books. And Viktor Belenko, is that right? He was the pilot in the MiG-25. He's in Top Gun Days. There's a picture of him in the photo section, and they took him. They took him flying at Top Gun. So,
Well, there you go. That's one thing I do always learn something new on this program. So thanks very much, Tim and Gareth, for that. Okay, we're going to take another break, and after the break, we're going to come back and get some of your feedback.
Hi, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, and with me is
Max Flight, and we're both from the Airplane Geeks podcast.
And we're so crazy about UAVs that we've decided that we needed to start a whole new podcast. Yes, folks, you're going to get an extra half hour a week of Max and I.
Yeah, David and I have been hard at work producing this new podcast that focuses exclusively on unmanned aerial vehicles and systems. And as David mentions, it's a weekly show, 30 minutes in length. And we bring you news and opinions and industry experts.
And we've already talked about some very cool stuff. We've had a former Airplane Geeks guest, Jamie Dotson, on, as well as We have talked about UAVs staying aloft at 65,000 feet for 5 years, and we're trying to put a positive spin on UAVs. We're not trying to talk strictly about military uses, but the commercial uses as well.
So we invite you to take a look at the UAVdigest.com and give us a listen.
Or download us from iTunes. So we look forward to your feedback and hope you enjoy our new podcast. Again, that's the UAVdigest.com.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show. Now, one item that we put out into the social media feeds was an article from the Telegraph in the UK about the replacement for the Nimrod. And we asked the question about whether we felt that it had been a waste of money following the route the government is taking. So a bit of feedback. Ben Ippolito from Down Under said they'd be mad not to choose the P8. David M. Vanderhoof, who is, of course, the historian for the Airplane Geeks, jumped in with the Nimrods being scrapped was dumb. I hope the RAF can recover this loss of capability. John Exley said, hold on, we have Airbus. So I'm not quite sure whether Airbus, I know they've been muted to potentially bring in an aircraft up to that specification, but I think that probably would be a long shot.
They're putting in the C-295 MPA.
Be interesting. Neil Graham threw his hat into the ring. Andrew Drew threw his hat into the ring. Brian Elwick made his comments about the MOD and waste of money quite clear. Someone called Defence Expert on Twitter said that BAE systems have been sacrificed yet again, most likely with yet another bloody 707 variant. Not sure. Totally agree with that with my AvGeek hat on, but there you go. And we also had Elise throw in their hat in to agree as well that it was waste of money. So, yeah, that one really seemed to get everyone very excited. What's your guys' views then on where we're at with the Nimrod replacement? Again, Tim, we talked about it recently, but we've got no coverage at the moment.
Well, no coverage apart from trawlers, sort of fishing trawlers being told to, if you spot any Russian subs or anything, kind of, periscopes, please do tell the MOD.
Throw your nets out, yeah.
Yeah, there's, we've got, obviously, there's Merlin there's ships. There is no, MPA coverage, apart from allies. Obviously, we have those sort of allies. So, yeah, there is still a capability gap. SDSR is supposed to be in by the end of this year. And Smart Money says that is when the MPA capability gap will get recapitalized and when somebody will make a decision and say, look, this is now urgent, get on it. So the key question there is it going to be just a straight out buy or a lease or just like, we know what we want? Is it going to be the RAF or the Royal Navy, even MOD saying we know what we want? Let's just place the order. Or is it going to be more convoluted and we've got to have a competition and it's got to be requirements got to be in, there's got to be a fly-off, et cetera, which will drag it on a lot. And obviously then we'll get into the kind of politicking and the, kind of horse trading and, between the various defence companies. So that's the key question now is what happens in SDSR and whether it's an open competition or just a straight-out buy.
What would you like to see, Gareth?
Anything. I just think it's extraordinary that an island nation Catalina. is hotching together some sort of capability. This is at a time when I know there's commercial pressures and, you know, budgetary pressures all over, but, you know, we've got this incredible heritage for our sort of that maritime capability, but also our search and rescue. You know, that's just been privatized. I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that the service is going to be any less good, but at all. But, you know, this is something we historically have needed and have been very good at, and we've just had this ridiculous gap, you know, whether it's for military purposes or helping people in peril on the seas, as the line would go. For me, P8, I reckon.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm in that camp too. Okay, let's wrap this section up. We've had some fantastic feedback from you, the listeners out there. We've got some new listeners on board. Just wanted to pick one or two out to notify. Kangaroo Opals, who I would assume comes from somewhere down under, was very, very generous in their comments on Twitter. I liked the way they described our program as global with an enjoyable Rule Britannia bias. So thank you. Thank you very much. In a discussion with Grant, our good friend Grant. We've had some great feedback on iTunes as well, so appreciate that. But please do leave feedback on iTunes if you haven't yet done so. It is important. It helps us keep the program visible and bring new listeners to the show. Okay, over to the promoting aerospace segment of the show. I'm going to kick it off with a few shout outs I just wanted to make. The first one's for a company called artandplanes.com, and it's the work of an artist and designer called Laura Bravo. They've got prints, oil paintings, stickers, and all sorts of aviation enthusiast stuff. Laura's work's very original, and I'm very lucky to have a print of a Spitfire flying across the Union flag that she's drawn. I'm very, very impressed with it, and I just wanted to give Art and Planes a shout out. Thank you very much. I love your stuff, and I will be coming back for some more. Now, you know we love our t-shirts on Extended, and we found someone new, flyinggraphics.com, another British company, got some fantastic t-shirts. The Vulcan one in particular stands out, but I've chosen the F4 Phantom. We've just come out of Phantom Month, of course. A month or two ago, we had our F4 featured episode with Dave Gledhill, which turned out to be our most popular episode ever. So I've chosen an F4 Phantom t-shirt from them. But do look them up on Facebook or at flyinggraphics.com.
I do like their Bear Hunter.
Oh, I almost went for that. Almost went for that. But I could hear Dave Gledhill ringing in my ear, and I thought, I've got to go for the Phantom. Got to go for the Phantom. Okay, Tim, any shout-outs?
Yeah, we've got Royal Aeronautical Society is 150 years in 2016. So in part of the sort of celebrations and anniversary stuff in the run-up to that, we've got a new heritage website, which is www.aerosocietyheritage.com. And that's got some really interesting stuff about some of our treasures from our historical collections and archives, and things like Henson's aerial steam carriage from 1843, or George Cayley's notebooks, or Shorts. You know, the obviously Shorts, famous from you know, Shorts of Belfast, sort of Horace Short's notebook from 1908 to 1909. You know, so really, really interesting stuff from, you know, notebooks, sketches, artwork, photographs from the history of aviation. Well worth taking a look.
Now, I've been down there. I think it was, I don't know, episode 2 or 3, we did a feature on the library. I've got to say, it absolutely blew my socks off. So, again, a shout out for Tim and the society there. Fantastic library. But, of course, head librarian Brian Riddle really knows his stuff. So if you're in the Farnborough area, can ever get down there, I would just really, really recommend that. Gareth, shout outs.
Yeah, I'm a little bit behind the curve, but it is very appropriate, bearing in mind we've got Ed at Yeovilton this weekend. I know we've done this before, but I make no apologies for giving huge thumbs up to the Royal Navy historic flight. Not only did Lieutenant Commander Chris Gotko was presented with his Air Force Cross by Prince Charles at Buckingham Palace. That was for obviously his remarkable feat of airmanship with the Sea Fury at Culdrose last year. But Swordfish W5856 has flown for the first time since October 2003. It's a fantastic sight to see City of Leeds back in the air. Lieutenant Simon Wilson, who I know pretty well, is a really good guy. I know he'd be incredibly proud that he was at her controls for that trip. And how marvellous to see an aircraft like that back in the air. And hopefully we'll see her this coming weekend. So well done. They've had a tough few years one way or the other, and the Seahawk is still stuck in the hangar. We're hopefully going to see the Sea Fury back next year if they can continue to raise the funds for a new engine, etc. But well done to everybody on the historic flight, and we look forward to seeing it air day.
Excellent.
Yeah, hear. Okay, competition time. In our last episode, Grub Street Books kindly donated a copy of their latest book, An Alien Sky, written by Andrew Wiseman. And they had a copy signed by no less than 5 of the POWs to give away to a successful entrant. And we made a random selection from all of the entries, and I'm very pleased to say that Zach Yates from New Zealand won the book. So well done, Zach. Send me or the show a DM, a PM, or an email, and we'll tie you up with Grub Street Books, who, as I said, very kindly donated that copy of a very, very special book. So well done, Zach. And we do expect you to give us some feedback on that book once you get it. Okay, we do, of course, have our own giveaways. Go over to our website for our own FSX livery, our ringtones, and our screensaver shots. So we're looking at them all the time. We will update them. So do check in, see if there's anything you like. And, of course, you can always suggest maybe one or two you'd like to add yourself. Okay, that's it for the show. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and of course to Adam Carolla for using his airport-themed inserts this episode. The Adam Carolla podcast is available on the web, iTunes, and most podcast players. You can find Extended now on Stitcher.com and UKPodcast.com, and you can also find us on the PodDirectory.com under Extended, no leading E before the word Extended, and of course on iTunes. Now, before we go, and to leave it fresh in your minds, we've been entered for the UK Podcasts Awards, and we need your help in voting for us. So we'll put a link in the show notes, and we'll also tweet and Facebook it. But we only have until the end of July to get all the nominations in. It literally takes you a minute, no more, to just register and nominate the show in its category. We'll put the links there, so all you have to do is recommend us. We'd greatly appreciate your support. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm at RESTimR on Twitter, and you find the Royal Aeronautical Society's site on www.aerosociety.com.
And Gareth?
Yeah, you find me on Twitter at Gareth_Stringer. You can find the GAR website at globalaviationresource.com. And if you keep an eye this coming weekend, particularly on at GAviationR, I know that the chaps who are going to be at Flying Legends, which sadly clashes with Air Day this year, will probably be tweeting enthusiastically and extensively from Duxford, probably for all week. But keep an eye on that one.
And there's some great Battle of Britain coverage coming up as well, isn't there?
Yes, there is. We've got a lot of anniversary coverage in the pipeline, and obviously we're into the meat of the air show season, so yeah. Lots to come.
Okay, thanks, Gareth. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. Okay, with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everyone. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Bye, all. See you soon.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Right. Okay, let's give it a crack then. Three, two... Oh, is everyone recording? Sorry.
Stand by, Hannah. Sorry. Yep, okay.
So yeah. All good and well.
You nearly got to one.
I know. I am. Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Professional. Boom. Done that before. Oh, hang on. I didn't press the button. Let me do that again. That was perfect. That was brilliant. That was brilliant. Hang on.
By watching all the ins and outs and the nuances and all that sort of thing. So
fascinating. Not as fascinating as the fact that we now know that you're also scared of fire engines. So a little bit worried.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.